You're listening to another top-rated radio show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Good evening, everybody. This is Commander Garcia, and welcome. Yes, my name is Tom Garcia, and we've got a great show lined up for you tonight. I'm flying solo. I don't have Paula Lozon, my co-host, with me, and Nick Taxi's been filling in for her lately. But this was kind of a short-notice show. Believe it or not, even though we broadcast every Wednesday, I wasn't actually supposed to be here. So I'm glad that I'm here, and I'm glad that you are here. We're going to talk about some important things today that you're not going to get from the mainstream media. And if you search around the Internet, you'll find it. But I pieced it together and parsed out precisely what this administration is actually saying to us, and it's not good. We're going to talk about that, where Obama's vision for the future is for America, and the war on women, except it's coming from the Democrat Party. Yes, it is. And so we're going to play some conflicting sound clips and some of the stuff you may have heard, but we're going to discuss it in a way that I think makes it clear as to what the Democrat Party really is all about. So I just want to start off, though, tonight, because I saw something on TV, and I've talked about this numerous times before, but is it interesting how if this administration or any Democrat administration creates jobs during their time in power, that it's all to their credit? So if jobs are created, any jobs that were created, this is all Obama's credit. But any jobs that have lost, well, that was his predecessor. How does it work? How does it work that if you lose jobs, it's your predecessor's fault, but if jobs are created in this country, then it's all the president's credit, all his credit? In fact, tonight on The Five, Bob Beckel said, more jobs have been created under Democrat presidents in the last 50 years or 20 years or 30 years or whatever he said than under Republican presidents. Well, that sounds good, except if you want to use the logic that everything is Bush's fault, then all of those jobs created under those Democratic administrations were really the fault, if you will, of the predecessor. And finally, if President Obama does get reelected, will he still be blaming his predecessor? Because his predecessor now in his new term would be himself. So who is he going to blame? I guess he's going to have to keep going back to blame George Bush. In fact, if another Democrat were elected after a second term of President Obama and the economy just was muddling along and having problems and we had, you know, this massive debt that we have and are going to continue to have, will they continue, 12 years on down the road to be blaming George Bush? It's really getting old. It's weak. It doesn't work. It doesn't work anymore if it ever did work. But those are my thoughts on job creation. Now, I want to start off by a quote that's been floating around. I even put it on my Facebook page, and nobody's called me on it. But it's a quote from Norman Thomas, who was a presidential candidate for the Socialist Party of America, and he ran six times. And here's what you can find all over the Internet he said in a 1944 speech. The American people will never knowingly adopt socialism, but under the name of liberalism, they will adopt every fragment of the socialist program until one day America will be a socialist nation without knowing how it happened. I no longer need to run as a presidential candidate for the Social Party. The Democrat Party has adopted our platform. Now, if you go to Snopes, they'll go, it's not likely. But they don't have proof that it isn't. But we do know for a fact that Norman Thomas, in a letter in 1951, wrote that the American people will adopt socialism, just not that label. It's got to be called something else. So this is really in line with the statement I just read. And the way he explained it was, in California, and I don't remember what he was running for, but in California, where he was running on the Socialist Party ticket for some state position, he got 60,000 votes. And then he says in his letter, but when I ran the next time under the Stop Poverty in California ticket, I got almost 1 million votes. So his point is, just don't call it socialism. But that's what we're going for. So you say, well, Tom, you know, the Democrat Party hasn't adopted that platform of socialism. Well, let's take a look at it. Let's see what our commander-in-chief seems to think about this. There is a speech going around. It's all over the internet. You can see him himself being interviewed at Loyola University, October 19th, 1998. Let me read a little bit of what he says. Okay. I think the trick is figuring out how do we structure government systems that pool resources and hence facilitate some redistribution, because I actually believe in redistribution. Now, I'm going to have to keep going back and parsing out everything he said here, because there is some unbelievable rambling going on here, but it gives some real insight into our socialist in chief. He said, the trick is figuring out how do we structure government systems. Notice how he says the trick. Why is it a trick? Why is it a trick to figure out how we so? Because the government's not structured to be a socialist redistributive type of government, and it violates our Constitution. I'll get to that in a few minutes, but that is not the intent of our Constitution, which is the rule of law. And there's nothing in the Constitution about redistributing wealth. Now, you can say taxes, Tom, but we can tax people, and that can be in various ways redistributed. Yes, it can, but I'll get to that in a minute. So the trick is figuring out how do we structure government systems to pool resources and hence facilitate some redistribution, because I actually believe in redistribution, at least at a certain level, to make sure that everybody's got a shot. Now, what's that level? At some level, you know, just for the poorest people, well, he explains later on who that group is. And we'll get to that. So how do we pool, and this is him continuing, how do we pool resources at the same time as we decentralize delivery systems in ways that foster competition, can work in the marketplace, and can foster innovation at the local level, and can be tailored to particular communities? Now, let's back up. What is he really saying here? See, he's using a lot of vagaries, but he is telling us how he feels without being direct. Remember the quote that I read you from Norman Thomas and about how the label of socialism isn't going to work, but we can get people to adopt it. Because if we present the ideas in a way that sound good, then that's where we'll get them to go. So how do we pool resources at the same time as we decentralize delivery systems? Pool resources. Well, what resources are we pooling? Would it be the federal government and maybe the state governments? And to decentralize would mean the federal government would be out of the loop, except they won't be out of the loop. They'll be taking your money, but we'll let the states redistribute it. And that's where he said, foster innovation at the local level. I can tell you where you foster innovation at the local level when there's a massive redistribution of wealth. It's in Cuba. You got people secretly growing vegetables back in their yards or other places so they can just have some food, some normal food, because the government really doesn't give them enough. And they're always starving there. I mean, it's, you know, I've talked to some friends that have recently been there and visited, you know, hadn't been there in many, many years, and said it's terrible. Everybody's starving. So how do we pool resources at the same time as we decentralize delivery systems? Okay, we're going to get the states to do it. So we've really destroyed over the last 100 years state sovereignty, and it's going to be easy for the federal government to force states into doing its bidding. Competition, how do you have competition in government programs? There's no, the government programs are run by the government. There's no competition there. So when he talks about, it sounds good, foster competition, and that it can work in the marketplace. Well, let's just take a look at our tax system, for example. The federal government takes money from us. It goes to the Treasury, and it's used to pay for things, all kinds of things, military, government programs, and some government programs may be considered a redistribution of wealth because they give in the form of entitlements, whether it be food stamps, welfare, et cetera, to various people. But how is that's not the marketplace, that's the government. See, this is the idea of a socialist, and that is to take over the marketplace. The marketplace disappears because government is not a marketplace. Government does not generate any wealth. It only takes wealth. So he's totally being misleading when he says, foster competition, there will be no competition when the government does everything. There is no more marketplace. And the innovation at the local level is going to be you trying to figure out how you can feed your family by planting your own garden. And, of course, the EPA will step in and say, well, that's, you know, damaging to the environment and everything else. So maybe competition among state agencies? No such thing. And you know what will happen? When we talk about at the local level and can be tailored toward particular communities, the federal government is going to choose. And who's going to choose the agencies that develop to implement this redistribution? Oh, minorities, of course. If you're a minority, then you got it made. I got it made because I'm Hispanic, so I can get involved in getting paid by the government to redistribute your wealth. But when you hear that tailored to particular communities, does that give you a little bit of sense of Agenda 21? I mean, we're already talking about it's going to have to be decentralized. So at the state and local level, that's Agenda 21 right there, and tailored to particular communities, all Agenda 21. If you don't know what that is, go look it up. But there you have it, Agenda 21, in his 1998 speech, which didn't exist back then, but is a way to foster, if you will, use the president's term, this form of creeping socialism. And how do we figure out how to get around the Constitution and our federal law to take your money? Now, I should go back. This article was in the American Thinker today by Virginia Proden. So I want to give her credit for that. And here's what she has to say. When he proposed to redistribute wealth, Obama meant that the system has to find a trick way to transform your wealth into government's hands. That because our Constitution doesn't allow for it. Government then can distribute the wealth to others of its choosing. And how does it, like for the example of the stimulus, how did it choose to do that? Well, blue states got more than red states. Unions, I mean state governments, got a lot of stimulus money to help keep them afloat. And these are state governments that, you know, were in the red, severely in the red, and have large government employee groups. So that's what she's talking about. I've already kind of talked about that. And then she goes on. She goes on to say, your work and your wealth will belong to the government in the name of society. In other words, it will belong to the collective. Actually, though, your work and wealth will belong to the elite of the government, who will decide who and what is given your money. This is what redistribution of wealth means in Obama's philosophy. It is also the basic principle of communism. So what I described earlier from what he said in that interview in 1998, the first couple things I went through and parsed them out, that is how you structure a communist nation, a communist government. That's precisely how you do it. So the meaning of redistribution of wealth is government stealing and the end of your freedom. It's the beginning of your forced sacrifices for your leader, your government, and your society. This leads to a permanent realignment of power in society, and has been seen in Europe where the rise of a dictator has been seen frequently in communist society. Now, because we're sort of talking about communism here, if you go and take a look at the Bill of Rights in the Soviet Constitution, you are guaranteed all kinds of things, kind of things that Obama talks about, things that FDR put in his second Bill of Rights, guaranteed job, guaranteed wage. The Soviet Constitution even guaranteed leisure time, and it goes on and on and on. But there's always a catch. Now, let's see if this is in alignment with what I just read from his interview and what it will take to make this happen. It's the duty of every citizen of the Soviet Union to abide, now this is in their constitution at the end of their Bill of Rights, to abide by the constitution of the Union, Soviet Socialist Republics, to observe the laws, to maintain labor discipline, in other words, do what government tells you, honestly to perform public duties, do what the government tells you, the elites, and to respect the rules of social intercourse. It is the duty of every citizen to safeguard and strengthen public socialist property as the sacred and inviolable foundation of the Soviet system, as the source of wealth, in other words, government, the source of wealth and might of the country, as the source of the prosperous and cultured life of all working people. So government is put first, and everybody must bear allegiance to the government. Now, what does our Constitution, our Declaration of Independence say? It's all centered around government protecting our individual liberty and sovereignty. And yet what I just read about redistribution of wealth is not only the blueprint for communism, but it's the blueprint for government being number one, you being number two, and no more individual liberty and sovereignty. That's precise. Because that's the only way you can redistribute wealth in that manner. So let's talk about the poor and the folks that he is saying. If you remember, he said he believes in redistribution, at least at a certain level. Well, what level is that? Well, he said not only the poor, but the working poor. And that would be, now this is 98, so you know numbers change a little bit, in his 4 years gone down, but he said working families that are making $30,000 a year. So he's looking at creating a coalition that will be a majority. And this is what he said about the poor and the working poor. They're struggling, and to the extent that we are doing research, figuring out what kinds of government action would successfully make their lives better, we are then putting together a potential majority coalition to move those agendas forward. And a majority coalition means a majority of Americans that will vote for us and we'll stay in power. Now, let's go back and analyze. There are three sections of this we have to pay attention to, this last statement. He said, to the extent that we are doing research, figuring out what kinds of government action. He says research. He doesn't say taking action and successfully making lives better. Just doing research to figure out. That's the first part of it. But the research is a code for figuring out how to violate the Constitution and federal law, how to get around it. Whether they're able to do it or not, it doesn't matter. As long as we're just researching and talking about it, then we can build this coalition because people will say, oh, he's going to make things better. Just wait. And that's always what the communists say. Well, just wait. It's going to be better next year. Or it's going to be better. What's his whole campaign today? Forward. Don't look back. Just it'll be better. Don't pay attention to what happened in the last 4 years. So as he continues on, would successfully make their lives better, we are then putting together a potential majority coalition. Lives better. What does he mean by lives better? Not by better paying jobs. Not by better education so that you have the ability to get a better job. Make your lives better by government giving you more. And remember, this is all about redistribution. So we're taking it from other people to give to you, not helping you get ahead and get wealthy like the supposed wealthy people are going to take it from, but government. So he wants to build a majority coalition of people dependent on government and even more dependent than they are today. And that's really the whole purpose of redistribution of wealth. That's precisely why communists talk about these things, because they want power. And then they can stay in power if the majority of people are dependent on government. So we're gonna listen to a clip a little later on that has to do with something completely else, but it does actually tie into this. You know, we talk about making your lives better, but it's not by better job, it's just by more government assistance and a majority coalition. So anyway, we're going to get to that. But and that's under the heading tonight of the assault on women, the war on women that actually the Democrats are perpetrating. But I want to take a little bit of a break here now and play a clip of our president talking about making changes to Washington. Now, you may have seen these clips, but if you haven't, you've got to see these. What did he say in 2008 when he was campaigning? And what does he say today about changing Washington? So you're going to first hear him, and I've interspersed some commentary there, but he says it in an interview. He says it at a rally. And then we get to see him talking about it today and what the difference there is. It's about 40 seconds long on changing Washington. First, he says, we've got to do it, and we're going to do it. And then he says, I can't really do it from inside.
Washington is broken. My whole campaign has been premised from the start on the idea that we had to fundamentally change how Washington works.
Now listen to what he Okay, I had to stop that. He said his entire campaign in 2008 was structured around the premise of changing Washington. He needs to be elected so that we can change Washington. And then you're going to hear what he says the truth is.
Washington is broken. My whole campaign has been premised from the start on the idea that we had to fundamentally change how Washington works.
Now listen to what he said in a rally later on in 2008.
What I want to focus on is who can actually deliver on change. Because I believe that change will not happen unless we change how politics is done in Washington.
Okay, did you hear that? He said, unless we change how politics is done in Washington. Now let's hear what he has to say about all of this today.
The most important lesson I've learned is that you can't change Washington from the inside. You can only change it from the outside.
Wow. So the most important thing he learned, in other words, he didn't have a clue when he ran for office in 2008. He truly believed, and or maybe he knew differently, but he believed that he could change Washington, and you had to elect him to go to Washington to make those changes. Now what he's telling us is he's learned that he was wrong. I really don't want an incompetent, naive president running this country, serving this country. I really don't. But he's admitting, essentially, he's admitting outright that he was wrong. His entire first campaign, as he said, was predicated on the idea that Washington must be changed from within. And now he's telling us it can't be done. Well, then we need to kick him out of office so that he can now be on the outside and make all that change that he says that's where you can make it from, is from the outside. Amazing, isn't it? So, I mean, the guy's either a liar, or would just say anything to get elected, or he's completely incompetent because he's always having to change his story. Just like, you know, when he said he would cut the deficit in half by the end of his first term. And it's, it was $400 billion, I think, in 2007. And George Bush did not sign the 2008 budget, or the 2009. So 2008 was $400 billion. He didn't sign the 2009 budget. It was his budget to sign, but Nancy Pelosi held on to it until after the swearing in of Obama. So Obama actually signed it. So if we want to go back to the last budget that George Bush actually signed, $400 billion, so we have tripled that last year's deficit under Bush, tripled. And and if you want to know that Nancy Pelosi stuck in an extra $400 billion in that budget, that's why she didn't want George Bush to take his pen out, because he probably would have vetoed it. He could have vetoed it. Wanted to leave it for Obama, and then Obama would say, well, that's really not my budget. I'm going to sign it, but it's not really my budget. He could have easily vetoed it. He didn't have to sign it. He absolutely didn't have to, but he wanted all that extra money to be printed. So we're constantly hearing two different issues, and today now he's saying, well, it's, you know, he inherited a big mess. Well, look, if you run on a campaign of making promises that I'm going to cut the deficit in half, and then you admit, well, I wasn't able to do it because things were worse than I thought, well, then you're incompetent. That's the bottom line. You're incompetent. But he made a lot of promises, just like he's making now, that he'll never be able to keep. But let's talk about the war on women. The first thing we're going to talk about is the way Democrats treat women. They either treat them as people who just aren't engaged. They just, you know, stay at home, except we're all supposed to believe that, you know, they have the right to get out there and break the glass ceiling and get jobs. And many have. But they're portrayed as like Stepford wives, the way they talk about them. So let's hear what the president said about being engaged and holding your elected representatives and government accountable. And then what his deputy campaign manager said on NPR radio just the other day.
So that you can be an active citizen holding your public servants and elected officials accountable. That's one other aspect of citizenship, is paying attention.
So Obama makes it pretty clear that being a good citizen requires paying attention, and holding our government accountable.
That you find most often with women, they're not really concerned about what's happened over the last 4 years.
Yeah, So what is the Obama campaign saying? The women aren't good citizens? The women don't care about their citizenship and aren't concerned voters? He made it clear that it's a duty of your citizenship to pay attention. But Obama's deputy campaign manager, Stephanie Cutter, just said that women haven't paid attention. They don't care what's happened in the last 4 years. to me, I played that for my wife and said, what does it sound like she's saying? The women are stupid. The women just, aren't smart enough to pay attention to politics and be involved and engaged. Now, if we go back to the DNC convention, I mean, that was just a big love fest about abortion and birth control. And, we had woman after woman after woman trumpeting the greatness of abortions. And I got this from Ed Morrissey, the Fiscal Times article that he wrote, just a little paragraph about it. And if you'll remember back, the strategy segregates women from other issues as if they only have deep concern in this election over the status of their genitalia. This theme came to ludicrous fruition in demonstrations by Code Pink at the Republican convention in Tampa when activists, yes, Democrats, showed up dressed as gigantic labia. The scene provided an unintentionally revealing portrait of just how progressives see women in modern society. If there's a war on women, that war is on the intellectual aspect of the women of this country, that they aren't intellectual enough to be engaged. All they think about is their reproductive rights and that the economy and their family and feeding their family and raising children or getting ahead in a career, none of that matters nearly as much as reproductive rights. And they really don't have the time to pay attention to this stuff anyway, because they just want to hear what Obama's new promises are. See, that's essentially what Stephanie Cutter said. They don't really care about the last 4 years, how bad it was, how good it was. They just want to hear what the new promises are. And finally, is it interesting the progressives want us to stay out of their bedrooms? It's a privacy issue. How they practice sex, who they practice it with, et cetera. But they want us to pay for what's going on in those bedrooms and the result of what went on in those bedrooms. Stay out, but pay. Yeah. Okay. That's nice. So those are the two areas I want to talk about tonight. And we've got the president himself making it very clear he believes in a redistribution of wealth. And as he outlined it, it would be very similar to a communist-driven government and society. That's the only way to make it happen. It's the only way it's ever happened like that. And then the war on women is a war on, really, the intellect of women in this nation. Democrats treat them as they're stupid, as if they're stupid. And they're only concerned about one thing, or two things, reproductive rights and what are the new promises going to be from the president. The final thing, as a retired military officer, I want to bring up this whole incident in Libya. And, the president made a promise that we're going to make sure that our people and their consulates around the world are safe. He should have made that promise before this all happened. He should have ensured that before this all happened. But he didn't, because he's incompetent. But we've got new information now. And, the Democrats want you to believe that, well, it's new information. We didn't know it back then. No, I'm telling you what we now know. That the government, this administration, knew within 24 hours of the attacks in Libya. Within 24 hours of the attacks in Benghazi, U.S. intelligence agencies had strong indications al-Qaeda-affiliated operatives were behind the attack and had even pinpointed the location of one of those attackers. Three separate U.S. intelligence officials spoke to the Daily Beast and said that this early information was enough to show that the attack was planned and the work of al-Qaeda affiliates operating in eastern Libya. Nonetheless, it took until late last week for the White House and the administration to formally acknowledge that this was a terrorist attack. So why did they just keep saying, no, 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 it's the video. Oh, no, it's the video. It's not a terrorist attack. And then they won't even say the word terrorist attack. I think they actually, somebody has said, maybe the president said, an act of terrorism. But why would they keep trying to hide that? Because it's a pure politics. The Democrats don't want, and the media doesn't want you to know, that this president is completely incompetent at securing our nation and our interests abroad, at home and abroad. top of it. He doesn't know what he's doing. He's way in over his head. He is an amateur. He's way in over his head. He's not capable and competent. And quite honestly, I don't think he really cares. I mean, I've never seen at present more engaged in leisure time and less engaged in national security and other important issues. He gets his briefings on a piece of paper. You can't ask a piece of paper questions. That's not being engaged. That's not being proactive. We hired him to be proactive and engaged. We hire all presidents to be proactive and engaged. He's not proactive and engaged in the least. So the intelligence officials who spoke did so anonymously because they weren't authorized to speak. Well, that's usually how it works. They said U.S. intelligence agencies developed leads on four of the participants of the attacks within 24 hours. For one of those individuals, the U.S. agencies were able to find his location after his use of social media. We believe we had enough to target him. There was very good information on this in just the first 24 hours. There are camps of people and a wide variety of things we could do. Have we done it? No. Wasn't promised, but no, we haven't done it. But another U.S. intelligence official said, I can't get into specific numbers, but soon after the attack, we had pretty good beat on some individuals involved in the attack. But did we do anything? Absolutely not. We're more engaged in apologizing than we are. Now, to show the level of cover-up from this agency, we've got the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, Susan Rice, said, well, you know, we are basing this on the best information that we have, that it was spontaneous and not premeditated. The best information they had? No, they had information within 24 hours. These statements were made 5 days after the attack. So they had all this information for 4 days up to that point. 7 days later, former press secretary to Obama, Gibbs, defended Rice, saying she simply did the best she could given the intelligence available time. Now we know that, no, she didn't. They were covering up. So the Newsweek bulletin contradicts both Rice's initial statements and Gibbs' apology. Meanwhile, the Libyan president appeared on NBC Today and stated the obvious, that the Benghazi attacks had nothing to do with any protests or Islam-demeaning internet videos. In fact, there are some news outlets that are reporting that there were no protests that even existed prior to the attack. So the attack occurred first, not the protests, then attack, but the attack, then the masses and mobs and joining in on the revelry and everything else like that. But that's all been covered up. Is this an administration that we can trust, whether it be Fast and Furious or Eric Holder telling us that some minorities just don't have the DNA to get a voter ID? In other words, they're too stupid. That some minorities essentially are too stupid to get a voter ID or an ID of any kind. Is this the kind of administration that we can trust? That are constantly lying to us, constantly covering up, absolutely intransparent. Do a search of Thomas Sowell on transparency. He did he compares Obama 1 to Obama 2, what Obama said and how he's actually acted, and it goes deeply into the absolute lack of transparency and constant cover-ups by this administration. And I thought about going over that tonight, but I didn't want to drag things out too long. This has been a sort of a quickie tonight, but some good stuff. And just remember, we have a president who is rooted in the concepts of hardcore socialism, and that's where he wants to take us. And he wants to redistribute your wealth. And he wants to do that so that he can create a majority coalition so that Democrats can stay in power forever and ever. As long as we have the majority of Americans not only just dependent on government, but highly dependent on government, then we will have a whole new social and government structure that we don't currently have today, but we're heading there and we're getting close. All right, thanks everybody. Michael Cutler, he'll be back in the air Friday night. I filled in for him last Friday night. Don't miss that. And we'll be back next week on Wednesday night at 7 p.m. again, and Nick Taxi will be joining us. So don't miss that. Thanks for being with us tonight. Stay safe out there, and we'll see you next week.
listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.